You're listening to the Colorado Springs Real Estate Investing Podcast, brought to you by RECO, your local guide for all things real estate investing in Colorado. Hey, Colorado Springs, this is Jenny Bayless, and I am with Dan Haberkos again. You may remember him from a few weeks ago when we discussed Pueblo West and land and all those interesting topics that we chatted about. And I wanted to have him back because he is into doing new construction. And that's just something that I've never personally dived into. So, you know, just wanted to, ask him a million questions. I'm sure that everyone else is thinking about out there. So thanks so much, Dan, for coming back on.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, Jenny. Should be fun.
Yeah. So I was telling you earlier, I don't have, you know, a order of events on this one because I really don't even know where to begin. So Maybe that might help. So I'm guessing that it has something to do with, you know, the fact that you need land to build the new construction on. So is that kind of where you start off?
Yes. So that's a great starting point. I think the first distinction that should be made is what I'm doing versus, well, infill lots, which is what I'm doing versus what a lot of the developers are doing out east, you know, by the airport, which is taking raw land, developing the land, and then building on it or selling it to the big builders. So really simply, the lots that I'm buying here in Colorado and Florida and so on are all infill, meaning that all of the preliminary work that goes into taking just a raw piece of dirt and getting it ready to be built on has already been done. So the process of taking that land and subdividing it, getting it zoned, going through the city, hiring a civil engineer, all that has already been done for me. And then all of the utilities are built out. So they're just ready to be tapped into. So it makes it very, very easy what I'm doing relative to, you know, I have a friend doing this way out east of Denver, and it took him, I think, 14 months to take a big parcel and turn it into 15 or 16 lots, right? And then it's ready for construction. So important distinction there. I'm not dealing with raw land. I'm dealing with shovel-ready infill lots.
Great. Yeah, I've heard that that is a really difficult stage if you're literally just taking dirt as opposed to the type of lots that you're referencing. Because I imagine the street, you know, curb and gutter, is that already put together as well? Okay, great. So that's great that you don't have to do any taps or anything like that. You're just ready to build.
Yeah, I have to pay to tap into the existing utilities, right? So tap fees in Pueblo are a big deal right now. They're about to go up in Pueblo West. But yeah, the water and sewer lines are there, the power's in the back. So I don't have to, you know, hire a civil engineer and figure out what is it going to cost to extend the streets and the utilities and that sort of thing, because that's already been done. That can be very, very profitable because a lot of the institutional builders will not touch land unless it is shovel ready. So if you get with them, you can go find where they want to build, take those huge parcels, do all the subdivision, and then sell it off to them for a huge profit. But that's not what I'm doing. That's a whole nother strategy.
Okay. So what happens next? Do you have plans for the building? Do you have to work with an architect and then, you know, marry that up with a general contractor? How does that part work?
Yeah. So if we're taking the perspective of someone who doesn't know about building, but let's say they want to get into it, the first thing I would want to do is get several bids, assuming you've identified the market, you know, hey, here's land that's going to work for what I want to do. You need to get bids from general contractors and see if there's even a margin that makes this worth doing. So this specifically, let's talk Pueblo West. That's where I have the most experience. It made a lot of sense because the lots were so cheap, especially when I was down there a few years ago, and you could still get them for $5,000 to $10,000. And all of that work had already been done. And at the same time, sales prices were $250,000, $260,000-ish for the simple 3-2 that I was building. So yes, you do need to get a plan that the general contractor can then bid. But if it's me, and I'm looking at doing any sort of new project or endeavor, I always think, what is the quickest way that I can figure out whether this is viable or not, right? I don't want to spend a whole bunch of time on it and then find out, oh, no, this doesn't work. So I reached out. I talked to other people building down there, got really simple plans from them for just a 3-2, 15-ish, 100 square foot. And I used that to get some general bids from general contractors, approximate bids from general contractors first. So just I always think through what's the quickest way to figure out if what I want to do is feasible, and that's how I'd approach it. Now, let's pretend we know it is. Maybe you have a friend building in your market and you're positive that it works. Well, okay, yes, you're going to need either a designer or an architect, and this does vary. So in Pueblo West, I can just hire a designer. I don't even believe he has any sort of license, but the rules vary by municipality. So I pay $450 to $550 to get a set of plans and a plot plan from him.
Okay.
And then that is what I send, you know, over to the lumber company or over to my GC to get bids for all the materials and labor.
Okay. So when you were mentioning we'll just call it a sniff test for lack of a better phrase. Did you just have a buddy that was down there that, you know, hey, yeah, you can borrow these plans and we'll just, you know, do a feasibility study on it?
I actually got a couple different sets of plans, generic plans from the designer that I use, and then sent that over to my GC, said, which one should we build? You know, that sort of thing. One more important point just on the topic of plans. I am building something that is very palatable to what I see as the two biggest demographics right now. So especially in Pueblo West, it's first-time millennial home buyers, a lot of them military, and or the retiring baby boomer coming from a more expensive market. And so I know people building much larger homes up in Denver, and that would give me a lot of anxiety, because it's if the market drops, I feel safe having built a simple 3-bed, 2-bath, 1,500 square foot entry-level home with a big margin where I can drop the price. Right, I see a lot of safety in that, as opposed to maybe, yeah, you can build luxury homes and make a lot of money, but that would scare me a bit. So I picked a plan that I felt comfortable with and I felt was palatable to my quote unquote avatar, right? With any business, you want to know who is my avatar, who am I selling to or buying from? And for this market and this product, it's very consistently one of those two that I just mentioned.
Okay. So the person that's doing the design, like, do they create like, yeah, it's going to be, you know, 5 pieces of 2x4 here and so on and so forth. Do they get that granular for the plans for the GC, or is that something that they work with together to try to figure out, like the GC says, yes, in order for me to create this wall, I'm going to need these materials?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the plans are detailed enough where I send them over to the lumber company, and the lumber company does the back end work, communicates with my GC to get the specifics. Sometimes there'll be small modifications. There was just on the last one, but it's a matter of them communicating. So I get the plans from the designer, send them over to, I've been using Foxworth Galbraith, and then they communicate with my GC and discuss all that. And I don't really have to have my hand in that at all, honestly.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. I was thinking that, you know, I was just like, what level of background would you need in, you know, design or engineering or anything like that to be able to do it? So it sounds like they talk to each other.
Yeah, I have no, that is not my skill set at all. Yeah. I have no idea what looks good or you can't, yeah, anything details, I'm pretty useless. So yeah, it's more a matter of finding good people that are good at each of those parts of the process that you're not. So finding a designer that came highly recommended and then the GC that I watched successfully build for several people I know, right? So finding good people and then putting them into the system is really all I'm trying to do. I just see building houses as really, I just look at the big picture and take the principles of investing and what makes sense given the current market and trends. I don't see myself as a specialist with building homes. That just makes sense right now. So it works. So yeah, a lot of the granular details, I would have to defer you to people that I hire. But as far as the high level, I can walk through all that very simply. Yeah.
Interesting. So depending on what lot you have, does that kind of change plans? Like if you, I imagine that you probably have like, you know, a couple plans that you pick from, you know, oh, this, you know, plan A, B, C, this is what I'm looking to do. Do you ever have to kind of change things based on the land itself, you know, kind of elevation, that sort of thing?
Yeah, that's a great question. And most of the time that is normal, where you probably should have a couple sets of plans. I will say specifically in Pueblo West, those lots are just the same thing, one after the other, after the other. You know, in the center of town, they're all 80 foot wide, right? And they have the same. So what you're getting at is, you know, of course, topography, and then there's setbacks. So maybe you get a lot that's a little skinnier and you look at the zoning code and, oh, it's 5 foot setbacks on each side and 15 feet total. And that this is more of a problem down in Colorado City, where you do have to use different plans or skinnier houses because a lot of the lots are very skinny down there. Now, specifically in Pueblo West, that isn't much of an issue. And I've been building just the same thing over and over again. But in many markets, it is. You know, if you have a downward slope, for example, a walkout basement might make a lot more sense, or vice versa, you know, changing the plan if it's sloped the other way. You're right. But I haven't had to do that much in Pueblo West because it's just a desert with the exact same size lots over and over and over again.
So, wow. Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, just kind of where that question came from, you know, mm-hmm. I live up in Monument and it's a very diverse topography here. And yes. Every single house is like, you know, individually designed for that lot. So mm-hmm. That's why it's so fascinating that you found a location, you know, an hour from Colorado Springs that allows you to essentially be cookie cutter for that. So that's phenomenal. Yeah.
And I sound way smarter than I am in hindsight. A lot of what I'm saying, I just learned from people that have been doing it for the last 40 years. So for anyone listening, most of this is just I've learned from other people and implemented myself. And actually kind of as a corollary to the conversation we were just having, I've kind of set up the buy box to fit with the plan I want to build if I'm looking for more lots to build on. So in Pueblo West, I haven't built anything. Well, there were a few pre-sales a few years ago, but almost everything I've built has been right in the center of town where it's all R1, R2, R3. And those lots are always 80 foot wide, you know, 99% of the time, always the same depth, always flat, you know, so that just makes it really, really simple. And then the lots that don't fit that mold are ones we just flip.
Okay. Yeah. I love that you have like alternate options. Mm-hmm. And I think that gets people into, or, you know, out of a lot of trouble is if you have a lot of different exit strategies for that. So That's very interesting. And then, you know, you're just able to scale it at that point. So once you get into, you know, the actual build process, I guess we'll kind of skip ahead a little bit to designing. Mm-hmm. Does the city have any sort of requirements as to like a color scheme that you have to use? Because I imagine that you're not in an HOA community. And if you are, that's probably even more difficult to work with. How does that kind of, you know, come out?
Yeah. So this is going to be entirely local. We'll use Pueblo West. They have the architectural committee. And so one of the things my GC does in process of getting the permit is submits the plans, the plot plan, all of that, all of the materials over to the architectural committee and make sure they approve it. Now, specifically in that market, drive around, they're pretty flexible as to what they allow people to build there. But, you know, that's obviously not the case everywhere. And every municipality is going to have some sort of process where you have to get it approved so you don't go build, you know, a pink house that's really oddly shaped or something like that, you know? So that you do have to get it approved, but that's pretty easy in Pueblo West if you're building just a normal house.
Okay. Yeah. I was wondering, like, you know, like you said, if you had 10 blue houses right next to each other, I imagine that they aren't big fans of that. They probably want to kind of mix it up a little bit.
Yeah.
So what is the common, you know, shovel to, you know, closing on a new build?
Yeah. So it was consistently 5 or 6 months. Then the pandemic hit and that kind of, so we've had some that have been all over the board in the last couple of years. I've got one where we broke ground, I want to say January the 15th, and it's completely framed out, roof's going on, windows are in. So this one's moving much, much quicker and the full build time is only going to be probably 4 or 5 months. In normal conditions, on a simple house like this, it should be, depending on what sort of GC you go with, somewhere in the 4 to 6 month range. But again, that's for these simple, I almost see it as a commodity, simple 3-bed, 2-bath ranches we're building.
Yeah. How many projects at one time do you typically have going on?
Well, I told you about the water situation, so I got kicked in the teeth. So I had one close 2 weeks ago, and I've only got 2 more builds going right now. I'm hoping, it looks like Pueblo West is going to open back up. So I'd like to get several more going because I like to have 4 or 5 going and then it complements the land flipping very well. But yeah, that was definitely not expected. And for anyone who didn't listen to the last episode in January, well, I think it was exactly 2 months ago, they put a temporary moratorium on new builds in my primary market because of water issues.
So is it easier, you said 4 to 5 is your goal to have going on. Is it easier to just schedule, you know, trades that way? Like they just go house to house to house. Is there a reason for, you know, or is there like a perfect balance for
that's more of that? Just my personal goals, financial situation and comfortability.
Gotcha.
Than anything. Okay. Yeah. That's entirely subjective.
Okay. Yeah. I wasn't sure if there was like a sweet spot for like, I have all the drywallers going, you know, so this days, so on and so forth. So
ultimately scale provides that more than anything, you know, if you're just doing a big subdivision, but I'm not looking to raise that sort of money or take on that sort of project, given everything that's going on in the macro environment.
Yeah. So just curious, do you mind sharing, you know, even in rough percentages, kind of the difference between the cost for you to build a house pre-pandemic and then post-pandemic, because you know that's all we hear about is supply costs and supply shortages and this, that, and the other. So I'd love to hear that.
Absolutely. So there was a simple 3-bed, 2-bath, 1366 model we built over and over and over again pre-pandemic. And I'm pulling from memory here. I want to say all the costs except what's on the settlement statement. So taking, not including, you know, the realtor fees, if we used a realtor, closing costs, any concessions, basis was right around 190, 195 with a 250 sales price. And we rarely actually used a realtor. So there was consistently about 40 to 50 grand in that really simple house. Now, consistently got the feedback that it needed to be a little bit bigger. So the model building now is 1477. So about 111 square foot larger. This one I had just mentioned that is all framed out and everything, it looks like we're going to be closer. Oh man. I mean, I know we're live, but I'll pull this up real quick
and look at
it to make sure I don't get it wrong. I've got the numbers right in front of me because I just updated them again with my GC because they changed. Now, obviously the land prices have gone up. Everything has gone up. So same sort of deal, not including the real estate agent commissions or anything like that. It looks like the basis is going to be right around 270. And then this is going to be, this one's going to be good though. Sales price is 395 and that's spot on with comps. Okay. Granted, there will be two real estate agents in the middle of that. I just listed out it. She almost functions as a project manager too for me, which is awesome. So that's a big chunk on a $400,000 house, but there should be like 80-ish, 85-ish in that one. So that'll be a good project.
Okay. Yeah. That is really substantial for the increase in that. I mean, that's a really good, I think, just, you know, zoomed in level of, you know, to give an example for everybody of, you know, the impact of just supply chain costs and then, you know, how that translates to an actual home and, you know, on a larger scale as to what, you know, really the whole country is dealing with right now. So I think that's a really good case study for that.
Yeah. And it works so well with the land business because I'm buying these lots at 20 to 50 cents on the dollar. And that just creates such an extra margin of safety too, because saving money there. And you know, I had the one that closed earlier this month didn't do nearly as well on total profit was closer to 40 on that. But I bought the lot. It was down in Colorado City for $1,000 on Holly Dock Golf Course. All utilities in place, $1,000. So
Okay.
Yeah. So that really, really helped because we really messed up on a couple things. The soil quality was much, much worse than we thought. And it was much harder to get contractors down there. But still made a decent chunk, partially because the land was bought so cheaply. So the two businesses kind of complement each other really well there.
So were you playing kind of catch up on prices, or do you have a very dynamic pricing model? Because, you know, I'm personally just curious, like what came first, chicken or the egg, in terms of did sellers start increasing, sellers of new builds start increasing their price in anticipation? Hey, knowing, you know, just, hey, I'm getting billed more from my suppliers. I need to increase my sales price. Or was it just you kind of took a hit on a couple and then went, I need to reevaluate things?
So prices were already slowly going up before the pandemic and all the supply chain issues. But at the same time, all the high under people from the Hope, from all the Hope interstations, they are coming down now too, and they're used to playing 600,000-800,000 a month for any sort of house or a place that he's paying $2,000 or $3,000 a month. So to them, it doesn't really make anything. So it's kind of a mix. It's hard to say which of the two really pushed it to go up, because it kind of seemed to be both of them.
Okay. So yeah, let's talk about financing for for these. How do you, you know, do you have just like a line of credit, you know, with like a construction loan, or how does that typically work? Is it hard money, private financing?
Yeah. Yeah, so hard money honestly has worked the best. I've used Hard Money Mike repeatedly.
I've worked with him before. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I've used him many times. and then I used, what's it called? ABC a number of times, but they are really difficult to deal with. Looking at a couple other small local banks, I'm actually going to see if I can get a line of credit on one of my more built up houses here, and see if I can just do it for cash from one of those next time. But yeah, it's been a mixture of ABC and then the hard money lender we're talking about.
Wow. Okay. I was thinking that there would be more, I guess, cheaper financing in place for that. So unless, you know, maybe you guys worked out a long-term arrangement on that, but yeah, that would, you know, start to add up quite a bit for hard money.
Well, when there's enough of a spread and you're putting no money in it other than maybe just the lot,
yeah,
it's not that bad. And I've just had such an issue with some of the, like ABC, just being so slow and making it very difficult. So I'm going to give a couple other those small banks a call actually this week. I had it on my calendar, and we'll see. But ABC was difficult to work
with. Okay. Yeah. I mean, well, you brought up a good point, though. We're kind of, you know, diving into a different topic, but with hard money, I know a lot of people talk about hard money, like eating into profits and all that. But, you know, this, like you said, you don't have any of your own cash into it. So everything's pure profit. So even if you're spending, you know, 10%, 12%, you know, in loan costs, it's still pure profit to you. So it's better than nothing.
Yeah,
better than not doing the deal.
I also made a deal with them where it's it's like a line of credit where, let's say it's a $240,000 loan. I'm not getting taxed on or billed on anything or interest on anything until I draw it. So it was $300 the first month because I only had $50,000 pulled, and then, you know, so that helps too if you set it up that way. It won't really be that substantial.
Yeah, and I'm sure that they appreciate the fact that you have the same product, the same business model. Over and over and over again, they can just cut the check and, you know, they know what to expect on their end.
Yeah. And I just send them the invoices. So I don't have to, you know, pay the invoices and then get a withdrawal for myself. Invoices go to them. They pay them directly. That's it. Makes it very, very easy.
Okay. Yeah. So that's interesting. So do you know what type of products are more, are provided by from, you know, more institutional type lenders like local banks? Are they usually on a draw schedule or something like that?
Yes. With ABC, they'll usually bring someone out to check. And then I want to say they're at 1 or 1.5 percent points or points up front as an origination fee, as opposed to 2 or 2.5 with hard money. And then I want to say rates in the 4.5 to 5 as opposed to like 8 or 9, potentially 10.
Okay. Yeah, that's, I mean, not too bad. I'm sure, you know, that's pretty considerable, or, you know, right in the middle of a long-term loan and a flip loan. So that makes sense.
Yep. Exactly.
Interesting. So I know we talked about it last time that you typically just sell these properties resale. Is that kind of the process that, you know, you guys try to aim for at the end, and then every once in a while you'll get an investor buyer out there?
Yeah. So with the current state of things, I would be very nervous about a pre-sale where, you know, they just have the land and, or we just have the land and we're pricing it up front. There's got to be some sort of caveat as far as, oh, if it goes up X amount on our end, we're also going to take the sales price up, because it is crazy right now. Lumber's going back up and all the uncertainties in the world. So if we ever have a more calm environment, again, pre-sales are great. A lot of banks will finance 100% on a presale. It can be a great option, but with the pandemic, like Cabaret, for example, I didn't have her seriously advertise that here until we had all the wood paid for, because of course that's been one of the biggest things fluctuating. So now she's seriously advertising it, my realtor on that one.
Interesting. That's a really good point. I know that there was a news article in Colorado Springs about a builder that, you know, canceled the contract because prices went up. I think it was like 50,000. You know, you can Google it if you're interested in listening. But So I thought that was like very interesting. It's bad for both parties. I mean, I feel awful for the buyer, you know, but it's just kind of like one of those like, oh man, what do you do in that case?
Yeah, so. That happened to a lot of people. I forget exactly when lumber shot up, but in the middle of 2020, this sort of thing happened when the lumber just went nuts. You know, it's been high for a while, and then the sales prices also increased. So a little easier. It still works right now, but there was a moment there where a lot of people were under contract for $250 to $270 for a simple starter house, and that just wasn't feasible when lumber just tripled, you know? So.
I feel like that would probably be the biggest hurdle, you know, for you guys right now would just be, you know, appropriate pricing and then trying to figure out the supply, on how to, you know, capture that and, you know, without, you know, making it too expensive of a product on the other side of things. So,
yeah, it's crazy at $395, because when I bought this lot, I expected we were probably going to sell this plan at like $375. And at $395, we've gotten a bunch of feedback of price just right. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been such a weird, you know, dynamic that we're in, but I think that you have a really good, like bird's eye view of exactly like why things are happening the way that they're happening, because, you know, you're taking land and you're getting, you know, building on it and getting a house. So you can kind of see every single stage as to what is causing that on a larger scale. So that's really interesting.
It has been very interesting watching people just move right down the front range. Because I was down there for the first time in 2018. And, you know, I remember buying and selling lots in Colorado City and nothing was happening in 2020. And then all of a sudden houses started popping up. And so, you know, the one we just closed last 2 weeks ago was in Colorado City, building another one all the way down in Colorado City, because it's crazy. There's demand all the way down there. And if you talk to a couple of the other builders, everything they sell is pre-sold. So it's just gone straight down I-25.
Wow. So what is your involvement in terms of project management? Are you just really saying like, oh, hey, lumber company, you need to speak with the GC. Have you guys gotten together yet? Is that, you know, kind of high level what you're doing? Or are you, hey, plumber needs to come to this home? Or
no, absolutely not. No. The goal is to set up systems and put other people into them. So, you know, like on Cabaret, it's communicating with the lender, make sure the GC and the lumber company and everyone got reimbursed. But that's about it. I'm checking to make sure he's staying, you know, at or near the budget. But yeah, that is really it. Obviously, I communicate with my realtor on leads she gets and if anything's coming from that. But I am not spending much time on this one, especially because I trust this GC now. It's pretty darn minimal. And that's also why, you know, it's funny. I had someone tell me, oh, no, don't list it with the realtor. You know, there's these $900 listing options. There's a realtor who'll just put it up on the MLS for $900. And I said, yeah, but she does so much. She communicates with the GC, communicates with the, I would much rather leave it that way. And I think of the opportunity cost on that time and what I can spend that time on elsewhere, right? I'd much rather pay her and then go and work on other things.
Yep. You get what you pay for.
You do. Yeah. You do.
Yeah. That's a really good point. And that's actually very surprising to me that you are so uninvolved in that. You know, so obviously that's, you know, everyone's probably end goal is to remove themselves from the process and have systems in place. So I think that's phenomenal that you've been able to figure this out in just a couple of years.
Thank you. And again, I just went and found people that are already doing it. I'm not creative. And you know, I was talking with a friend who is doing really well, but he works like crazy. And I don't want to do that. I like to spend more time thinking and planning. Because when I really look at the last couple of years, when, you know, the Pareto principles, the 80-20 rule. And I almost think 5, maybe 10% of the things I've spent time on, the decisions I've made have really gotten me to where I am. And so I try to work less, think more, plan more. And I feel like that has really benefited me. Because I just think of small decisions or realizations I had that were completely or very, very impactful. I try not to be busy all the time, and I'd rather enjoy myself and have time to think than be working my butt off all the time. So I've gotten good at balancing that, because from 16 to 21, all I did was work and go to school. And so I said, nope, not doing that anymore. So
yeah, I'm impressed that you were able to, you know, to do that in such a short amount of time and have, you know, have a company that is functioning very profitably now. So yeah, I'm very impressed by that. I need to learn from you a little bit more on, you know, how to step back some and just turn it over to the, you know, to the experts.
It's taking time. And I started working very young. When I was 16, I was managing a portfolio of rentals and a farm at the time. So all through college, I ran a landscaping company while going to school full time. So, you know, those experiences taught me a lot.
Yeah. So what's next? I feel like you've really, you know, perfected what you have going on in Pueblo West. Sounds like you're in Colorado City as well. What's next for your business?
Great question. So there's a couple things. I mean, I'm a little bit on the personal side right now, working to buy that house for my girlfriend and I. But aside from that, we're just moved into a market in Florida, closed on the first lot there as of today, actually, and then a couple more under contract. So I have a VA that just started this week. And of course, I'll be involved in it first as she gets started and used to what she needs to do. Ideally, she'll just be more communicating with my acquisitions manager once she's fully trained and on board. But so getting her up and running to help support just a significant increase in deals. And what I'm hoping here or planning is, if the market I'm in Florida has the same sort of demographics moving and the same things happening, just like the markets here are, which I think it does, I'm going to try and get a few builds going there as well. But again, I'm going to start with some land flips and make sure that works as expected and things are going as expected. And of course, you always learn about, you know, out there you deal with more floods. And obviously, that's not something we have to worry about here. So there's always nuances of different markets. So working on scaling that and then getting, hopefully, we'll know here in the next 48 hours if Pueblo West lifts this moratorium, we'll get a couple more builds going there. And then in the long run, I know what I need to do to accomplish what I'm looking at in the long run on the investment side is go learn from someone who's already in the commercial space. And by that, I mean industrial/retail. That is the space I'm really interested in. And I have just been lazy and haven't gone and figured it out like I should have. So that's on me.
So why Florida? What drew you to that area?
Talking to a couple of my older friends, they gave me a number of areas and markets that were similar. Huge tracts of infill lots, basically, is what I know and love because it's so easy. So I found this market through them, and I looked at it, and it had a lot of the same characteristics where, you know, Pueblo, for example, people love Denver, they love the Springs, and then it just got so expensive, they just got pushed further and further down I-25. At the same time, you had all this money that was put into subdividing the subdivision many, many years ago. So it's shovel ready. And at the same time, it also appealed to the retiring baby boomers because taxes are super low. It's more conservative. And so the market in Florida I'm looking at has all those same factors where tons of money was invested years ago to subdivide it. It kind of failed. Most of it didn't get built out. But now all the people from the surrounding coastal areas are getting pushed out. Prices are increasing like crazy on the land. All these people bought land 2, 3, 4 decades ago for pennies on the dollar, what it's worth today. So it has a lot of the same characteristics. And then the biggest thing, though, is just thousands upon thousands of lots that are exactly the same as far as utilities, zoning, and size, which just makes it easy.
Okay. Yeah. And I guess that you can really put your systems to the test since you're going to be long distance. So yeah. I think that'll be a really good, you know, kind of a trial to see if you've, you know, honed in on everything, and then you'd be able to reapply it back here to make your life a little bit easier.
Yeah. I rarely go down there anymore. You know, I flipped a couple lots out in South Fork. I never saw them. Or I flipped lots in Colorado City. I never saw. So it gets easier with time. It's crazy. You know, you just deal with problem after problem. And eventually it's like, oh, I've solved that problem 10 times before. And my acquisitions manager knows. So like, you know, getting a death certificate or, you know, taking it through probate, or we're working on a quiet title right now. Stuff like that. You know, you do it a few times and then it's just another simple part of the process.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. So I guess, would you say I've forgotten to ask you anything, you know, from a general overview of the new build process?
I would want to hit quickly. We did touch on it, just the difference between pre-sales and just building a spec. So spec house speculation, which is what I'm doing right now, is where there's no buyer yet. You're assuming that you're going to be able to get it sold down the road. And just to reiterate, I would be really careful, guys, right now, because of the craziness in the commodity markets, I would build on spec. It's almost safer right now. Make sure you're building a product that is very palatable to whoever your avatar or your end buyer is. But there are a couple builds in 2020 we did where we made almost no money because they had been pre-sold and prices went nuts. And then, yeah, it just, so pre-sales were excellent for many years. You know, ABC Bank would do 100% financing on it because it's, you know, assuming there's good credit and they're pre-qualified as far as the end buyer. But in today's world, specs almost are a little bit safer. And the other big thing I would hit on is wherever you are, there's nuances and subtleties of every market, right? From what the municipality is looking for. Like I said, I can just use this designer to do my plan, so it's super cheap. And then I get an engineer to do the foundation, soil test and the respective foundation. But that's not doable in Denver. I need an architect to do the plans in Denver, right? And so it's more expensive. Or another thing, right? Like Lehigh in Florida, where I'm talking about, there's different sorts of flood zones and flood insurance required. Whereas that's not a problem out here. Out here, we're more dealing with shortages in water. So if you go buy land in Fountain right now that doesn't have a well or water rights, you're in trouble. They're out. So you really, you need to find someone who knows your market and who understands the process and learn from them so you don't get burned, because there are always going to be subtleties of your market. But ultimately, building houses is very, very simple. I have a friend much older who has been a mentor in many ways. I remember the first time I met him in 2018, he said, "And building houses is child's play." And that was very, very intimidating to me at the time. But nowadays I look at it and you go, you're right. It really is, once you know, it's very simple.
Yeah, that's hard to wrap my head around, but
understandably.
You know, just, yeah, like, I mean, even just, you know, my small projects that I do with my rentals, I'm like, oh my gosh, it's such a pain in the butt to have to, you know, basically project manage all these things going on. So the thought of building an entire home is very overwhelming, but you know, I'm so impressed by everything that you've set up. And, you know, just copy paste, it works. So you found a system, you found a process, and you make it work. So it's very interesting. And I'm really happy that you were able to share that story with us.
Thank you. Yeah. Happy to share it too, guys. And again, I'm not that smart. I just went and found someone who had 40 years of experience and learned from them. That's really it there.
Yeah. So tell everyone how they can find you. I know you said it in our last podcast, but just refresh everybody.
Yeah, Dan Haberkost on social media, Instagram, Facebook, lots of pictures of mountains and projects I'm doing. And then I just made a simple website, danhaberkost.com, with all different projects I'm doing, rentals, new builds, that sort of thing.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Dan. I really appreciate you taking the time and talking to us today and explaining that whole process and breaking it down for us.
Sure. Thanks, Jenny. This was fun.
Thanks, everyone.